This podcast episode is sponsored by the Eremos Institute, a unique Australian forum for authentic and diverse spirituality. Eremos publishes a magazine and hosts events, including intensive journal workshops online and in person. The intensive journal method is an integrated system of writing exercises created by Ira Progoff, a scholar on the work of Carl Jung. See the Eremos website for upcoming workshops at www.eremos.org.au.
They fly to the centre, usually golden, of the blossom, hum busily and work the flowering plant, and then the fruit sets. As we well know, this activity is focused on the centre and serves the queen who lays the eggs and thus renews the life force of the hive.
We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, water and sky country on which this podcast was developed, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Circumambulating the centre, the symbolism of the bees, the honey, and the hive, was a talk given to the C.G. Jung Society of Melbourne by Frith Luton in 2013. My name is Danica Byler. Welcome to Season 4 of the podcast. The C.G. Jung Society of Melbourne offers a space for the communication, exploration, and development of Jungian ideas and practices. The Society conducts a monthly virtual lecture, offers a selection of short courses, and houses a specialist Jungian library for use by its members. This lecture explores the alchemical union of opposites through the symbolism of bees, including love and war, sweetness and bitterness, the individual and multiplicity, regeneration and death. Circumambulating the hive is linked with the mandala symbolism and the archetype of inner order. The speaker for this podcast episode is Frith Luton, a Zurich-trained Jungian analyst working in a psychotherapy private practice in Melbourne. She holds a Bachelor of Arts with honours in History, a Diploma of Education, Graduate Diploma in Editing and Publishing, and a Master's of Analytical Psychology. Frith has been a professional book editor for over 25 years and is the author of the book Bees, Honey and the Hive.
Good evening, everyone. It's good to be here. Tonight, I'm going to talk about the bee, as Derry said. The bee's been long represented and venerated by humankind. It features in creation myths and the religious and cultural symbolism of many peoples. Tonight, I'll consider aspects of the image of the bees, the honey and the hive, through amplification of the symbolism, which is the method C.G. Jung used when working with dreams. So I will circumambulate the symbol as if it was part of a dream that we're trying to understand. I'll look at it from various angles, various aspects, to see what we can discover about this wonderful symbol and part of our natural world. Tolstoy, in the epilogue of War and Peace, evokes the beehive with eros and open-heartedness, expressing that human knowledge is indeed limited when we're confronted with the innate wisdom and power of nature, or in psychological terms, of the unconscious or of the objective psyche. I'll read you the quote from Tolstoy. Just as the sun and each atom of ether is a sphere complete in itself, and at the same time is only a part of a whole inconceivable to man through its vastness, so every individuality bears within it its own ends, and yet bears them so to serve general ends unfathomable by man. A bee settling on a flower has stung a child, and the child dreads bees and says the object of a bee is to sting people. A poet admires a bee sipping honey from the cup of a flower. A beekeeper noticing that the bees gather pollen and bring it to the hive, says that the object of the bee is to gather honey. Another beekeeper, who's studied the life of the swarm more closely, says the bees gather honey to feed the young ones and to rear a queen, that the object of the bee is the perpetuation of its race. The botanist observes that the bee flying with the pollen fertilises the pistil of the flower, and in this he sees the object of the bee. Another, watching the hybridisation of plants, sees that the bee contributes to that end also, and he may say that the bee's object is that. But the final aim of the bee is not exhausted by one or another or a third aim, which the human intellect's capable of discovering. The higher the human intellect rises in the discovery of such aims, the more obvious it becomes that the final aim is beyond its reach. All that is within the reach of man is the observation of the analogy of the life of the bee with other manifestations of life. Some other focusing quotes. I've got one on the life of the bee for you, just to focus on while I weave this bigger picture. Carl von Frisch, who won a Nobel Prize for his research on the dance language of bees, said, "The life of the bee is like a magic well. The more you draw from it, the more there is to draw." And then there's a famous book that was written in 1901 by Maurice Maeterlinck called The Life of the Bee, and he wrote about opening the bee box or the hive. "The first time we open a hive, there comes over us an emotion akin to what we might feel at profaning some unknown object, charged perhaps with a dreadful surprise." The symbolism of the bee is vast, and it links heaven and earth, God and man, the plant and animal kingdoms, sky gods and earth goddesses, including the supreme sky gods, the sun gods, and the Great Mother. Honey and the nectar it's made from is almost universally regarded as the food of the gods. Ever since humans first discovered the sweetness of honey and began searching for wild hives so that they could harvest the honeycomb, the bee's been venerated and seen as one of the wonders of nature. And I'm talking about Apis mellifera, the honeybee here, not all our wonderful Australian native bees that are a little bit different. Bees are social, industrious, beautiful, but also terrifying in that they've got a powerful sting and venom and can act en masse. They can get very aggressive if an insensitive human being or animal disturbs their hive or threatens to rob their precious honey stores. Honey, the miraculous sweet golden substance or healing elixir that is produced by the bees, can be seen as one form of the alchemical lapis or stone. In fact, in Arabic alchemy, we find the stone sometimes referred to as honey. While the bee sting has been likened to that of the arrows of Eros or Cupid, the god of love, the bee's honey making, the regulation of the hive, that is the whole colony, and the dedicated care for their queen symbolically have much in common with the gold making of alchemy and with the entire alchemical opus and its processes, and thus with the psychological individuation process that C.G. Jung describes. The symbolism of the bee, honey, and the hive intertwine, but at the core is the imagery of the circumambulation of the centre. For bees, this is a dynamic in the service of the queen bee and thus of Zoe, what Karenyi refers to as the indestructibility of life. Psychologically, it's linked with the mandala or the sacred circle or the archetype of inner order, and that's an important point to remember. This centre or inner directed focus, a dynamic of movement, circulation or rotation around a centre, is not only fundamental to the religious instinct, the human religious instinct, but is also quintessential in what C.G. Jung expresses in descriptions rich in alchemical imagery of the psychological individuation process in which the centre is named the self or inner God image. I'll now speak to you a little bit about the bee in nature. You read on the program, I was a beekeeper and I enjoyed my work as a beekeeper. It required an observance of a certain other rhythm of life. It took me into nature and wilderness areas and meant that I observed more closely which flowers were budding or blooming at any particular time. For example, the yellow box is in trouble at the moment. I learnt about particular trees, including forest eucalyptus trees and seasonal blossoming, and how crucial the early spring pollen sources, like capeweed that the bees were working today when I went for my walk, including spring flowering weeds, are for nourishing the bees and thus for the natural cycles of flowering and fruiting in general. To work with bees is to be close to nature, to be actively aware of and immersed in the daily and seasonal, or the diurnal and seasonal rhythms. It's to pay close attention to nature, which is what the alchemists were extolled to do. The analogy of the growth of a plant from a seed planted under the earth is fundamental in the symbolism of the alchemical gold-making process and the individuation process of Jung's psychology, in which we have to observe our own nature, our own psychological development or unfolding. The beekeeper, and this is an important point to keep with us tonight, does not ultimately control, own, or domesticate the bees. Bees essentially retain the wildness of nature in spite of human attempts to select and breed hard-working, quiet, and stingless varieties. The history of beekeeping has not been a story of domestication, but rather one of humans learning how to accommodate the needs and preferences of the bees themselves. That's something to ponder. The roles of the bees in the hive, that stained glass window actually shows the different bees. I'll now mention some of the patterns and instincts of bees. If we can understand these more, then the symbolism of the bee, the honey, and the hive can be better amplified. The most important thing to realise, and the quality for which the organisation of the beehive has won the highest social and political praise, is this. The whole organisation of the hive is focused on one thing, the future of the hive. In effect, the hive works as a unified whole that self-regulates. It knows how to look after itself. There are many written accounts from over the centuries honouring the bee and recording the high regard in which the social organisation of the beehive has been held. For example, in 1578, Guillaume Gibartas wrote the following lines of poetry in a work called Divine Weeks and Works, and I quote, "Where's the state beneath the firmament, the sky, that doth excel the bees for government?" The bee has long been venerated as an exemplar of industry, diligence, community, order, chastity, a lot of these protections, I suppose, and for devotion to duty and order. Samuel Purchas in 1657, for example, in a work called A Theatre of Political, with two L's on the end, Flying Insects, commented that the bees demonstrated the invincible power of the multitude and that they would, quote, conserve community until their last. He added, "Bees are political creatures and destinate all their actions to one common end. They have one common habituation, one common work, all work for all, and one common care and love towards all their young, and under that one commander, that is the queen bee." In short, bees have been noted for their selfless service to the greater whole. In fact, very, very modern bee researchers talk about altruism and bees. And you might see on some of your office work stationery the honeycomb is a symbol, you know, and some books about good office practice have that as a motif. There are three castes of bees in the hive: workers, drones, and the queen. That's the drone at the top, queen's in the middle, and workers at the bottom in that picture. Almost all of the bees in a colony or hive are female, and the tens of thousands of workers in the hive are female. But the queen is the only true female. However, as the workers are underdeveloped females, so that they're not fertile, the drones are the only true males. The future of the hive is embodied in the queen bee, for she alone is able to lay the eggs from which will hatch the future generation of bees. A single queen lays up to 2,000 eggs a day, so the largest slender queen bee is the most important bee in the hive. And the queen's found deep inside the hive in the dark, which by some writers, like Maeterlinck, has been likened to a sacred space, a cathedral with walls of gold. And if you read his 1901 work, it's quite evocative. The honeycomb is the walls of gold. In the depths of the hive is where her creative output, the queen's, her great fertility, can be nurtured by the nurse bees. And they're actually called nurse bees, and the ones that follow her around are called her retinue, so it's very royal language. The symbolic significance of the queen is enhanced by the fact that she lays some eggs by a process of parthenogenesis, that is, reproduction without fertilisation, before she's been fertilised by a drone, and that these eggs result in drones, which in turn ensure that she'll be fertilised. And also, it's symbolically crucial to note that the queen mates high in the air and only during her one or few flights away from the hive. So she's mainly inside, in the centre, in the dark. She mates only with carefully selected drones, the fittest from the hive. And during a single encounter, the nuptial flight it's called, the drone, the male bee, provides enough semen for the queen to lay tens of thousands of eggs. And from then on, the queen's very fertile life is a process of never-ending egg laying. In a beehive, each bee has its role to play in the grand plan to ensure that the hive remains vital. These roles vary according to what's needed at a particular time by that hive. Worker bees make up the bulk of bees in a hive. They have a 4 to 7 week adult life. The queen lives 20 times longer than that, usually. That typically involves a progression, this is the workers, a progression from nest activities during the first 2 or 3 weeks to foraging. There are 4 behavioural phases or age castes, each of which is devoted to the performance of several different tasks. Bees are sensitive to environmental influences and can regulate or differentiate these tasks to match the needs of the colony. They're industrious, busy creatures. Each day, in response to sunlight, when the sun rises, the workers start flying, or if it's a full moon, if you have bees, they'll be out tonight, start flying from hive to flower or nectar source at sunrise. They return to the hive and communicate information, and this is a marvellous thing about the bees, it actually is a language, this dance language. They return to the hive and communicate information about the location of the nectar sources in their famous dance language. That's Carl von Frisch and some examples of the dance language. Waggle, lemniscate or figure of eight dances if the source is at some distance from the hive, or a circle dance if the source is close to the hive. Bees navigate by the sun's position, and Carl von Frisch pictured here, won the Nobel Prize for his research on the dance language of bees in 1973. Worker bees continue to work all day. The exception to this is during the coldest months of the winter in the Northern Hemisphere, when the bees cluster together, wintering. And that's what the process is called, wintering. The worker bees also build the honeycomb based on a natural template of hexagons, and in their roles as nurse bees, they rear the young bees. The workers feed the queen a special gel-like substance called royal jelly. They feed the drones, guard the hive against robber bees and other intrusions, like sometimes if a mouse comes in, they put wax around the mouse to seal it and make it hygienic in the hive. And they collect food, that's pollen, nectar and water. It's the worker bees who give the beehive and its occupants the reputation of busyness, industry, order and dedication to daily rhythms that enhance the future life of the hive and its epicenter, the queen. I've just got a few miscellaneous pictures there. There's a swarm up in the top left, and you can just investigate that while I speak. So worker bees, the asexual females, work very hard to bring in the raw materials for the whole hive and for the honey making process. They guard the entrance to protect the queen and the whole hive with its nursery and brood chambers and honey stores. They seal any gaps to the outside in the walls of wax honeycomb with propolis, bee-produced gum. So it's a well-sealed vessel. Some worker bees are nurses attending the brood, others are foragers and guards, but all have the queen as the central focus of their dedicated daily work. The whole energy of the bees is directed to serving this centre, a ruling principle around which the entire life of the hive is focused. The queen of the hive points the way to or symbolises the life-preserving, inspiring and nourishing eternal value of what in depth psychological terms is called the self. In cooler climates, a few hundred or more in a large hive, male bees or drones are reared for part of the year. The large furry drones, whose name has long been synonymous with, in English language, with laziness, exist only to mate with the queen. The drones mostly stay in the hive and are bigger and much lazier than the worker bees. They're needed in the summertime, the drones, as they're the inseminating force of the hive. Their reason for existence is the possibility of mating with the queen. In winter, because they're unproductive and would only eat the precious honey store and create more for the workers to do, when sacrifices have to be made for the good of the community, the drones are stung to death by the queen and workers, who then throw them out of the hive, or the drones. Now I come to a section on bees in mythology. Bees and honey are central in a number of myths, and I'll mention a few of them briefly, and this is worldwide that they're so important. The birth of Zeus and other different stories from ancient Greece, in particular Crete, emphasise the centrality of both the supreme sky god Zeus and the great mother goddess, whose realm was the earth and vegetation and extended to the underworld. The Great Mother is associated with fertility and the flux and flow of natural cycles, including, of course, the lunar or moon cycle. This here is a picture of a bee-headed goddess. It's a medallion from Knossos in Crete from 1500 BCE. And it's late Minoan, and you can see she's got two sets of bull horns on her head and the wings and dogs attending, and that bee narrow waist. The second chapter of Carl Perenyi's book on Dionysus is called Light and Honey. Here he talks about the overflowing of light and honey in connection with the birth of a divine child. For the Greeks, this child was Zeus, whose name originally means lighting up, but over time came to mean he who illuminates. The story goes, and I quote, "In Crete, it's said there is a cave of bees. There, according to the myth, Rhea gave birth to Zeus, and a religious commandment decreed that no one, neither god nor man, may enter. At a certain time of the year, a great fiery glow is seen emerging from the cave. According to the myth, this is when the blood remaining from the birth of Zeus overflows. The cave is inhabited by sacred bees, the nurses of Zeus." Kereni notes that for the Cretans, the divine birth flared up from the dark depths. It was more the bursting forth of life than the flaring up of a more spiritual, pure light. This gives us a parallel with the bursting forth of life of the bees at the start of the day as they leave the hive to gather the nectar from the flowers. According to Ovid, Dionysus was the inventor of honey, and his retinue, the Maenads, were said to have danced on ground flowing with milk, wine and honey, the nectar of bees. Milk and honey are the divine and miraculous sources of nourishment in various forms of paradise or promised land. For example, there's a biblical promise to the people of Israel that they would inhabit a land flowing with milk and honey. These unadulterated or pure natural substances are sources of fundamental and divine nourishment. The new life of both of these great but very different gods, Zeus and Dionysus, was fed with honey in birth caves of sweetness. While bees often made their homes in dark caverns, in many traditions and rituals of mortals, the first taste experience for an infant is that of honey and milk, the life-promoting victuals. Honey's the food of the bees. They need it to get through winter. It's what they work for. It's their water of life, if you like. Bees, with their sweet food, were the most natural nurses for a divine child, Kereni says, who was born and then kept hidden in a cave. The archetypal situation that nature offered was taken into the myth of Zeus. The bees offered men the essential sweetness of pure existence, the existence of infants in the womb. Now ponder for a moment about milk, wine and honey. They're products of an internal incubation process. And in the classical incubation rites or processes, for example, at the healing temples of Asclepius, the healing dream with its images from the unconscious was key. In other words, the light that comes out of the darkness or the unconscious. Such an incubation process occurs over a period of time, away from the interference of others. But what is needed is to hold the space, the temenos, for an individual to incubate their own inner process. Aristaeus, who's pictured there in the statue, was a Greek god closely linked with the bees and beekeeping, and he was a beekeeper. In fact, he's described either as a son of Uranus and Gaia, or that's a sky god and the earth mother, or according to a more general tradition, as the son of Apollo, the sun god, by a nymph or nature spirit. Aristaeus is regarded as one of the divinities most beneficial or beneficent to mortals in classic mythology. He pursued Orpheus's wife, Eurydice, and a snake bit her, and she died. Then Aristaeus's bees became ill, and they died. And with all his knowledge of beekeeping, he could not save his bees, he'd wronged a nymph or a nature spirit. For a cure, he had to turn to another nymph or feminine nature spirit. In despair, he called on his mother, Karini, who told him that the only person who could help him was the sea god Proteus, the wise but wily old man of the sea, shapeshifter. Proteus told Aristaeus that the gods were punishing him for Eurydice's death. Ovid's words, I quote now. Thus captured, he was forced to speak and told Aristaeus that he must bury the carcass of a slaughtered ox. And that from it he would obtain what he wanted, for when the carcass decayed, swarms of bees would issue from it. And the final sentence says, the death of one thus produced 1,000 lives. This sacred ritual of regeneration came to be called Bogonia. And perhaps this points to the need for a different type of more rituals in today's beekeeping, a more mindful and traditional way of beekeeping, which actually is coming back. There is this renaissance in backyard beekeeping, even in our Progress Press this week in the Boroondara area. There's a man in Surry Hills who's collecting swarms and encouraging people to have backyard hives. Time magazine had something more about the global crisis with which I'll talk about a little bit later. But there's a different type of mindfulness which was the traditional way of looking after bees. So this kind of ritual perhaps points to a need to have a different approach or a different attitude, especially in the face of colony collapse disorder in the highly commercial apiaries of the Northern Hemisphere. Some of you may have seen the Imhoff film More Than Honey, which was released last year, and a wonderful film. And it talks about this. Bogonia, birthed from an ox, shown in the picture, focused on the widespread belief concerning the origins of bees that instead of generating themselves, bees could spontaneously regenerate from the carcass of an ox or bull. And there are many other references in other cultures to this kind of regeneration, for example, the honey from the lion in the Bible in the story of Samson. So here we have an example of the way a transformation takes place in a closed vessel or space and results in a miracle of regeneration. And again, the sealed container is the important component in the story, as in the case of the milk, wine and honey. And that's what we talk about in a Jungian analysis also, this well-sealed vessel container. Delphi, in ancient Greece, priestesses in various temples were called Melissa, or Melissa, which is Greek for bees. The goddess Demeter, Artemis or Diana, the Roman name, the moon goddesses, and Aphrodite, the goddess of love and the mother of Eros, Cupid, of the arrow stroke sting, the god of love, who's often depicted being stung by a bee and holding a golden bow and arrow, all had connections with the bees. The great mother was known as the queen bee, and her priestesses were called the bees, Melissa. The Phthian oracle at Delphi was also known as the Delphic bee. Her symbol as a bee was depicted on Delphic coins. The traveller Porphyry in the 3rd century AD gave this description of later goddesses of Greece. The ancients gave the name of bees or Melissa to the priestesses of Demeter, who were initiates of the Chthonian goddesses, the name Melitodes to Chore herself. So it's all to do with the honey and the bees. The moon, too, Artemis, whose province it was to bring to the birth, or childbirth, I'm quoting, they called Melissa because the moon being a bull and its ascension, the sign of the bull, that's Taurus, Bulls are begotten of bees are begotten of bulls, and souls that pass to the earth are bull begotten. This image I'll explain in a minute. At the Ephesian temple of Artemis, the Melissae were accompanied by transgendered priests called Essenes, which means drones, as in the males in the beehive. And at the temple of Aphrodite at Eryx, the priestesses were also called Melissa, and Aphrodite herself was called Melissa, the queen bee. There's a further link from Aphrodite back to the bull. In astrology, Taurus, the sign of the bull, is ruled by the planet Venus. Venus Aphrodite is the goddess of love, and as I said, the mother of Eros. This image shows a bull bee goddess, and it's a, you can see that it's, there's some punctured marks on that skull of the bull, and it's actually a bee goddess of regeneration, that symbol that's been punched out in the bone. The links between the priestesses and the bees, as well as a bull, are many. To name these priestesses who had an important daily role in the sacred or religious life of a people after the bee indicates that the bee's work was regarded as being extraordinary and numinous and was highly honoured in their religious culture. We see the same in ancient Egypt, where the pharaoh bore the title and hieroglyph of the bee. The bees were Ra, the sun god's tears also. The Omphalos in Greece, Apollo's main temple, and oracle of Lithia were based at Delphi, near Mount Parnassus. Here, at Delphi, it was a spot reputedly marking the centre of the earth, which is called the navel, or the Omphalos of the earth. And a single significant stone often marks a sacred place or centre. Such a tall, upright stone would be a kind of axis mundi, linking heaven and earth, and the psychological dynamics of ascent and descent, as well as of circumambulation of a numinous centre, are present at such a place. These stones, like the one shown here, were often carved and shaped like skeps or traditional beehives, a basket kind of shape, traditional dome-shaped beehives, and some were decorated with carvings of bees with wings outstretched, as in the example shown here, to form a net covering the sacred centre. And the net's a symbol of the great mother goddess also. The Omphalos or Delphic navel of the world was regarded as a durable, reliable and indestructible centre from which the whole cosmos radiated out and to which it referred back for stability and movement, like the bees leaving the hive to fly at the flowers to the flowers at sunrise and ever returning to their queen and hive. Omphalos stones are frequently viewed as images of the psychological self. Now we come to another myth in which the bees and honey are important and they're linked with the form of divine inspiration and communication called divination. The Homeric hymn to Hermes tells of Apollo's gift to his newborn trickster brother, Hermes, of the three Delphic bee maidens. So that was the gift, three Delphic bee maidens. The hymn states, and I quote, "And when they are inspired through eating yellow honey, they're willing to speak truth. But if they be deprived of the god's sweet food, then they speak falsely." So if they were not fed honey, which the Hindus call the life or the sap of the sun, an image that evokes both the life urge and the flow, the truth or veritas was not spoken. These bee maidens represented something other than the oracle of Apollo, the sun god. Apollo's kind of wisdom took the form of logos-based, solar, far-shooting insights and knowledge, like his golden arrows, whereas the white face, they're described as white face bee maidens in the Homeric hymn to Hermes, divined in a less direct or less straightforward way. They were mercurial, betwixt and between, embodying knowledge of a more complete and flowing kind of wisdom that encompassed both the masculine and feminine, the solar and lunar. Their knowledge or wisdom came to consciousness through a process in which the solar and lunar have been combined, just as honey is the product of the sun, but also of the inner lunar process linked with the mystery of the queen and that darker realm. Bee maidens were three, and Hermes Mercurius was the fourth. The wisdom of the earth and the unconscious was present in the dynamic of this oracle, the gift of Hermes from Apollo the sun. These bee maidens were to teach Hermes the art of divination and intuitive wisdom, of reading omens and signs. Now, if these bee maidens are the teachers of Hermes, who as Mercurius is the alchemical bridge between the opposites, the sun and the moon, and Jung writes about this, and it is his job to feed them honey, Mercurius feeding the maidens honey, what does this mean symbolically, do you think? As we've discovered earlier, honey is the product of an inner, private, hidden process. Could it mean that he must bring the bee maidens the fruits of his own inner hermetic process or work in order for their work of education, that is, of teaching him the art of divination and intuitive wisdom, to continue? Bees are sometimes referred to as the birds of the muses, inspiring, so flying down from the heights, inspiring poets and love. They're also messengers between the worlds. And the fire and energy of bees reflects something of solar fire or a divine golden spark. So bees really seem to be a central symbol in the creation, salvation and understanding of the cosmos, of a sacred centre around which life circulates and rotates. Now I'm going to talk about alchemy and the individuation process. In the symbolism of the bee, there's a strong theme of an alchemical style of transformation of matter into an eternal substance or healing elixir, the honey. It's helpful to consider the symbolic parallels, and that says, I turn everything into honey. It's from a roof of a church in Switzerland, Hergisfeld, and it's linked with Mary, Mother of God. So it's helpful to consider the symbolic parallels between the psychological openness, opus magnum, the individuation process, the alchemical lapis making, the gold making, and the bees' honey making. The psychological individuation process, like the bees' honey making, is an opus magnum, a great work, with the hive of bees in some ways symbolising a community of itself, what Jung talks about as the ecclesia spiritualis, understood alchemically as those who take part in the alchemical transformation and union of opposites. C.G. Jung, in speaking of the importance of the psychological opposites, said at the beginning of his wonderful final work, Mysterium Conjunctionis, whose subtitle is An Inquiry into the Separation and Synthesis of Psychic Opposites in Alchemy, that, quote, the pairs of opposites constitute the phenomenology of the paradoxical self. And think about what a paradox is, man's totality. So the paradoxical self equals man's totality. That is why Jung says their symbolism makes use of, this is the symbolism of the opposites, makes use of cosmic expressions like heaven and earth. The intensity of the conflict is expressed in symbols like fire and water, height and depth, life and death. The goal of the individuation process is to achieve a conscious relation to the self. The goal of the alchemical procedure was most frequently represented by the philosopher's stone. Psychologically, developing an enduring inner centre is the goal, and everything is directed towards and circumambulates that centre, self. At the beginning of the alchemical process, there's what's called a massa confuser, and I don't think I have to explain what that is. It's like what it sounds. Not a union of, but a conflict of the opposites. And we now come to talk a little bit about the alchemical stages. So there's the negredo, the black stage. It's one of descent into the unconscious. One's old conscious attitude is no longer lighting the way, a bit like at the beginning tonight. This, as shown in the bee's wintering, can symbolise a time of darkness and depression. Then after this, vitality and light return in the white stage, the albedo. In a Jungian analysis or individuation process, next comes the difficult but very important stage of engaging with what could be called the problem of the anima or the feminine soul, that is relatedness of eros symbolised by the honey in this context, and animus, this inner masculine creative spirit. Introversion, much reflection and a well-sealed vessel are needed to contain this stage of the alchemical and psychological transformation, this dark stage. We need the fire and the passion and the ego strength to keep us going with our psychological exploration, otherwise we wouldn't continue, and the ego strength to structure these raw materials, as well as the sweetness, that love and that relationship. These things are the prima materia of the alchemical transformation process. We need to experience life and suffer our own emotions, and I think suffer is a true word, and our shadow side, our instinctive wildness, as part of the work of transformation. And in the book I wrote, Bees, Honey and the Hive, I talk about that and develop that idea a lot more. Just a few interesting things about the bees, and when I talk to various groups about the bees, they seem to like this bit a lot. So, like in alchemy and in the psychological individuation process, in which we start with the unrefined prima materia, the raw effects and excrement, if you like, the ultimate material, the honey, if described unromantically, actually begins as regurgitated nectar and aphid droppings. These are then transformed by enzymes in the bee's glands into a solution, which is then evaporated in the wax cells through a wing fanning action into a concentrated syrup. Nectar, the main raw material of honey, is a more or less watery solution of sugars that vary depending on the flower source, but always includes sucrose. So worker bees, they know how to travel up to 3 kilometres and in rare cases double that to reach a good source of nourishment. They work remarkably hard with great dedication, and they may visit as many as 1,000 flowers on each foraging trip, sucking nectar out of the centre of each flower and carrying it in their honey stomachs before returning to the hive to deposit the load onto the proboscis of house bees, who then disgorge or vomit the sweet liquid into the hexagonal waxen cells. In the process of converting nectar into honey, worker bees keep the inside of the hive at a temperature that assists to evaporate excess water and to concentrate the sugar content of the liquid, which is transformed into honey. And interestingly enough, it's the same as our body temperature. The maintaining or regulation of the brood heat in the hive is like ensuring tapas, a ritual heat about which Jung writes in his alchemical studies. The temperature of transformation and incubation in the hive, well sealed with propolis or bee gum, is kept just right, just as the heat of fire or level of eros needs constant attention and regulation in the alchemical vessel or the analytical temenos. It, as the alchemist Camarius says, in putrefaction and warmth there is created a remedy which permeates every body without hindrance. So the chemical process in the honey making ultimately produces this natural golden substance that doesn't deteriorate. Candied honey, you just have to heat it up and it, or put it in hot water and it, in a container of hot water and it flow again. It's a sticky substance which flows and washes off easily in water, which can crystallize but then regain its fluidity with a little heat. It's a pure, unalloyed, health-giving elixir with an eternal value. Doctors and healers, as well as their patients throughout the ages, have marveled at the usefulness of honey, not to mention its most acclaimed quality, its delicious sweetness. There's a beautiful quote that Rainer Maria Rilke wrote to his Polish publisher about bees, and I think this is important. He said, "We're the bees of the invisible world, we humans. We perpetually gather the honey of the visible world in order to store it in the great golden hive of the invisible one." Psychologically speaking, events, no matter how ordinary or humble, take on an importance when they participate in the process of individuation. It's like taking small steps, daily steps on a pilgrimage. The sacred centre's reached eventually. It's a daily round, like housekeeping, like the work of bees. So now we come to the mandala symbolism, the sacred circle. The bees swarm when there's a crisis in the hive, for example, when there's queenlessness or a new queen to rival, the reigning one hatches out. This is disorder before a new order is regained. Bees also have that famous dance language, and they move in circles and lemniscates to communicate where the nectar is, as I said before. Their foraging flights go out from and return to a centre, the hive, and a bee retinue circumambulates the queen at all times. The focus is on movement around the numinous and life-giving and sustaining centre. And this brings us to the mandala and to the archetype of inner order in depth psychology. The mandala is a magic circle symbolizing a psychic totality and expressing the pattern of life around the center. They exist all around the world and are well known in the colorful and intricate sand mandalas that you might have seen the Tibetan Buddhist monks make here in Melbourne, for example, and in the rose windows in Christian cathedrals. Mandala structure is usually a fourfold one within the quarter circles, and they often take a form based on an open flower like this one in my front garden from a couple of years ago, or the cross or the wheel. The deity or the god is at the center and is the focus of a sacred circumambulation. Jung, in his article concerning mandala symbolism, writes of the mandala, and he says, "There are innumerable variants of the motif, but they're all based on the squaring of a circle. Their basic motive is the premonition of a centre of personality, a kind of central point within the psyche to which everything is related and by which everything is arranged, and which is itself a source of energy. The energy of the central point is manifested in the almost irresistible compulsion and urge to become what one is, just as every organism is driven to assume the form that is characteristic of its nature, no matter what the circumstances. This center," Jung says, "is not felt or thought of as the ego, but, if one may say so, express it as the self." Edward Edinger describes circulation, also a stage in the alchemical process, psychologically, as the repeated circuit of all aspects of one's being, which gradually generates awareness of a transpersonal centre, uniting the conflicting factors, the warring opposites, if you like, There's a transit through the opposites, which are experienced alternately again and again, leading finally to their reconciliation that Jung describes thus. He says this painful suspension between the opposites gradually changes into the bilateral activity of the point in the centre. This in depth psychological terms means the beginning of the realisation of the archetype of the self. And I suppose now I'm going to come to the red stage of the alchemy, the conjunction, and the Heros Gamos, or the sacred wedding, and the springtime and the seasonal symbolism. As I close the lecture, it's a little bit more though. Jung has used the term self to express the idea of the centre, the totality of the personality, embracing all, both consciousness and the unconscious. And don't forget the unconscious in that definition. The centre of being has a thousand names, he said. The Atman in India, Christ in Christianity, the stone in alchemy, the diamond, the divine child, the flower, the circle, the square. All these are but a few of the symbols through which humans have experienced the central mystery of life. As in the individuation process, the hive, the living community of bees, is a strong example of natural vitality and self-regulation in a community of the spirit. And Marie-Louise von Franz, in her essay on the individuation process, which you can read in full in Man and His Symbols, wrote the following about the community of the self. She said, "But as is the case with all inner processes, it is ultimately the self that orders and regulates one's human relationships. The consciously realised process of individuation thus changes a person's relationships. The familiar bonds, such as kinship or common interests, are replaced by a different kind of unity, a bond through the self. The bees forage and work as individuals, but they share a bond through the hive." Rudolf Steiner once said, "The bee wants always to remain within itself, to stay within the sphere of its own substance. Every external influence is felt as disturbing, something to be warded off. As I've said before, the queen bee stays inside in the dark of the hive, and she generally leaves it only once in her life to go on her nuptial flight, when she flies up towards the sun and high in the air and mates with those selected drones. After she descends and re-establishes herself in the dark protection of her hive, she begins the laying of the eggs, which will continue without pause for the rest of her life. The poetry and numinous nature of what is the equivalent of the sacred wedding or Heros Gamos of the queen bee are registered in the nuptial flight chapter of Maeterlinck's book, The Life of the Bee, and it talks about how she appears on the threshold. She starts her flight backwards, returns twice or three times to the alighting board, and then, having definitely fixed in her mind the exact situation and aspect of the kingdom she's never yet seen from without, he writes in a very flowery 19th century, early 20th century way, "She departs like an arrow to the zenith of the blue. She soars to a height, a luminous zone that other bees attain at no period of their life. 2 days after the union, she lays her first eggs, and her people, her bees, immediately surround her with the most particular care. From that moment, possessed of a dual sex, having within her an inexhaustible male, she begins her veritable life. She'll never again leave the hive unless to accompany a swarm, and her fecundity will cease only at the approach of death. The way the queen starts her nuptial flight backwards and hesitates as she gets her bearings on leaving the darkness of the hive for the first time resonates with how we need to reorient ourselves as we approach a new level of consciousness or a new sunrise in our individuation process. In the symbolism of the bee, the honey and the hive, the opposites are strong, but alchemically, when the bright celestial spiritual masculine side comes down and descends to meet the dark but regenerative eros of the earthly female, which ascends, a new life, a new springtime and dawn, as well as a living stone, like an eternal resurrection body, is created. Life is alive and flowing, as well as radiating from a centre or source, a deep embodied wellspring which affects the wider world, the anima mundi, and that's indeed something to rejoice in. Jung says, we seldom find a high point of religious feeling where there isn't this image of the marriage of the extreme opposites. Or the royal marriage. What this means, he said, transcends human imagination, but wherever this eternal image or archetype is obscured, a person's life loses its proper meaning and consequently its balance. So long as he or she knows that they're the carrier of life and that it is therefore important for them to live, then the mystery of his or her soul lives also, no matter whether he or she is conscious of it or not. Marie-Louise von Franz wrote in Shadow and Evil and Fairy Tales, when the ego is not in union with the deeper layers of the instinctive personality, the ego gets torn between the opposites. If the ego could relate directly to the self, which is a unifying symbol like that of the queen bee, the conflict would fade and the ego would again function in wholeness. That is the normal way in which the opposites function, and the main impulse is again the flow of life, which comes from the totality. A conflict is never really solved. The emotion invested in it diminishes. One outgrows it by suffering and it becomes absorbed in a new form of life, with the result that one looks back dispassionately on it from a different angle. The red or rubedo stage of alchemical transformation, that in which the red gold is produced, is a stage of coagulation or completion. It's also linked with descent, earth, and circulation. The new life of the rubedo, the redness, flows from the self, not the ego. New life and emotion has begun to flow again after the dark black of the negredo. Consider Jung's words when asked in a film interview in 1957 to make some observations on the term mandala. He said, mandala is a very important archetype. It's the archetype of inner order, and it is always used in that sense, either to make an arrangement of the many, many aspects of the universe, a world scheme, or to make a scheme of our psyche. It expresses the fact that there is a centre and a periphery, and it tries to embrace the whole. It's a symbol of wholeness. So you see, when during the treatment there's a great disorder and chaos in a man's mind, this symbol can appear in the form of a mandala in a dream or drawings. A mandala appears spontaneously as a compensatory archetype, bringing order, showing the possibility of order. It denotes a centre which is not coincident with the ego, but with the wholeness I call the self. This is the term for wholeness. I am not whole in my ego, he says. My ego is a fragment of my personality. The centre of a mandala is not the ego, it is the whole personality. This is Jung still. The centre of the whole personality. It's a highly important and highly autonomous symbol that appears in dreams and so on, or in folklore. We could easily say that it is the main archetype. End of Jung's quote. Now I come to the golden yellowing stage and to the end of the talk. The alchemists praise the lapis or the stone in their writings as a living thing that has a healing effect on its environment, in which the divine opposites have spontaneously come together and so could have a healing effect in the world. This is actually a form of love, a deep eros or connectedness that flows from the individual human being who's become whole. The symbolism of flowering is important in the final stages of the alchemical opus, as it is in nature. The plant, for example, the fruit tree, flowers, and then the bees pollinate it. They fly to the centre, usually golden, of the blossom, hum busily and work the flowering plant, and then the fruit sets. As we well know, this activity is focused on the centre and serves the queen who lays the eggs and thus renews the life force of the hive. The result of the alchemical opus is often actually called its fruit. In love, there are sufferings to bear as well as joys, the sting as well as the honey. Through passionate love and the experience of deep eros, one moves beyond matters of the ego, and this can lead to the birth of the self. The analogy in alchemical writing is referred to as the problem of the multiplication. The alchemists say that at a certain moment when the philosopher's stone is made, that coagulation, the vessels open and the stone begins to emanate a transforming activity. So it's not just about not affecting the world. And every metal touched by it is transformed into gold. The analogy is that the philosopher's stone is made inside a vessel where it goes through dissolution in the darkness and then resurrects or comes back to life. The vessel, perhaps the skin of a beast like the bull in the ritual begonia that I mentioned earlier, is opened, the vessel's opened when the coagulation of the stone develops in what they call the process of multiplication, in which the effects emanate into the world or the surrounding environment. The psychological analogy seems to have to do with the fact that when one succeeds consciously and positively to relate to an archetypal constellation, the effect is widespread. In alchemy, multiplicatio is the yellow stage compared with the seeds or multiplication, the grain of corn that multiplies in thousands and thousands in the biblical sense. It represents a transforming emanation that extends even to the cosmos, the alchemists say. Bees flying to and from their hive represent in a natural living form this same unity in multiplicity. The solidity of the contained vessel is now able to become the solidity of the philosopher's stone, that is, a permanent inner experience of the self that gives the personality innermost solidity, making the need for a closed container, an outer artificial solidity or solidification, superfluous. Marie-Louise von Franz, yes. Yes, we started a bit late, I'm just about to finish. So she talks about the stages, and then Edinger talks about conscious carriers of the opposites. I'll be finished in about 3 minutes, Terry. Conscious carriers of the opposites, as Edinger calls these individuals with insight into their own actions, are aware of the operation of the opposites within themselves and have, to a greater or lesser extent, experienced this conjunctio, this union. And to the extent that such individuals exist and carry the opposites within themselves, they do not feed the exteriorization of the strife between them. So he says, when a sufficient number of people carry that consciousness of wholeness, the world itself has a chance to become whole. Von Franz wrote of this happening in a particular case of the transformed berserker. And she said, we can only integrate our personal shadow, not the collective shadow of the self, the dark side of the Godhead. Yet if we suffer the problem of the opposites to the utmost and accept it into ourselves, we can sometimes become a place in which the divine opposites can spontaneously come together. And this is quite clearly, she said, what happened to the Swiss Saint Nicholas von Flue, who had a vision of... His vision showed him that the divine opposites had become one with the self, and that the unified figure in this particular vision, a Wotanic figure wearing a bearskin that was sparkling with gold and dripping like an overflowing vessel of honey, she said, this is a love that flows from the individual human being who has become whole. And now I will end with Jung's quote from Mysterium Conjunctionis, paragraph 698, about the honey. Jung wrote, he was influenced by Paracelsus, the alchemist's work on this. He says, Jung, in the honey, the sweetness of earths, we can easily recognize the balsam of life that permeates all living, budding, and growing things. It expresses psychologically the joy of life and the life urge which overcome and eliminate everything dark and inhibiting. Where spring-like joy and expectation reign, spirit can embrace nature and nature's spirit. Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed Frith's talk on the symbolism of bees, where she explored hive activity as a metaphor for the human individuation journey, using beautiful imagery from mythology and alchemy. Thank you to our listeners, and we hope to welcome you in a live lecture or course soon. You can find our monthly lecture topics and further information about our courses on our website at jungsocietymelbourne.com. And we invite you to sign up for our complimentary newsletter for regular updates. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.